Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. It's just me and Oscar again. Fred is out once again this week, but hopefully he should be back next week. He said he would try and listen in, though. He may not be able to call in, but you can if you want to join in on our conversation. The number, as always, is 520-750-7456. And if you've missed any recent shows, they're available on the website, solomononblast.com. And if you want to email us with ideas or topics that you think would be worth discussing, our email, solomon@solomononblast.com. Or if you'd just like to advertise on the show, you can email us there at solomon@solomononblast.com, and we can bring you in as an advertiser. And when I look at the news stories each week, it's obviously that there's never going to be a lack of things to discuss. It's clear the world and the culture we live in today is in need of the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding that Solomon provides in the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Solomon's wisdom is as relevant today as it was when he wrote, and probably even more so now, especially the wisdom that there's nothing new under the sun when it comes to people's behavior. And that's because it's human nature, and most people have a belief system that isn't going to change easily. Their belief system is what drives their behavior. So if their belief system doesn't change, then for the most part, neither do their behaviors. The small changes we make in our behaviors may make some small improvements in our lives, but it takes an overhaul of our beliefs to really cause there to be an overhaul in our behaviors. How do you change your belief system? What would cause you to change your basic belief system? Usually takes a fairly significant event in a person's life to change it. I remember as a teenager, my friends and I were all into the muscle cars of the late 60s and early 70s. That was back when you could buy a 67, 68 Camaro cheap enough that even us young kids with just minimum wage jobs could go buy one. We each had our muscle cars and would spend a lot of time working on them, making them look cooler or trying to make them go faster. Initially, the changes were usually just cosmetic. We'd put on a chrome air filter, the chrome oil caps, and say, hey, I got an extra 5 horsepower out of the engine there. Or we'd do something to the exterior, maybe some racing rims, and then it would be like, hey, my car's 5 miles an hour faster. Obviously, none of these changes really did anything to give us more horsepower or go faster, and we knew that, but it was just kind of our joke amongst ourselves that, hey, you know, I got 2 more horsepower because they souped up the radio in the car. Anyways, but the cars always looked cooler. It wasn't until we actually changed out or overhauled the engine that we actually got that extra horsepower and faster cars. And that is a lot like how our lives are. You can make changes in your behavior, but usually they're small changes that end up being more cosmetic. Maybe you can stop swearing or you stop wearing those baggy jeans and figure out what the purpose of a belt is. And you may look and sound better, but if your decisions are still based on the same belief system that you had to begin with and it has no basis for the truth, then there really is no change. It isn't until we overhaul our belief system, just like those engines, that we see real change. And to some extent, I think that's what Solomon is pointing out throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. In Ecclesiastes 2:11, he says, then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. The little things we do with our hands end up amounting to not much of anything, but maybe some cosmetic changes. Solomon understood that what he did on his own was cosmetic, just like those chrome parts. It looks nice, but there's no real power change there. It isn't until God gets involved that the real power and the real change occurs. So my question when looking at some of these stories today is, what is their belief system based on? Is it based on the truth? Or something so far from the truth that in the end, it's all just vanity and grasping for the wind, as Solomon so aptly says to us in Ecclesiastes. So we'll be right back after these quick commercial breaks and take a look at our first story. And we're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Like I said, if you want to call, 750-7456. Has Hillary gone too far again? You know, like I said, Ecclesiastes, Solomon says, there's nothing new under the sun. And it just seems to be that it keeps coming back around. Proverbs 27:15 and 16 says, a continual dripping on a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Whoever restrains her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. Well, in this particular story, the headline is Hillary Clinton's possibly fatal email mistake. My question is that likely that anything is going to be able to stick and keep Hillary down? Like I said, in the Proverbs there, he says, restraining her is trying to restrain the wind. Grasping is like grasping oil with your right hand. But this guy thinks maybe there's a difference here. He says Hillary Clinton's email scandal showcases that she shouldn't be president, and that has nothing to do with her party or her politics. It has to do with how she seems to approach a decision. And he says, through tunnel vision leadership, this method isn't biased on the left or the right, but it's more hardwired into men than women. Unfortunately, Hillary seems to have this in spades. It may even explain mistakes like Benghazi better than any of the harebrained theories that her opponents have so far fielded. He says, tunnel vision is suicidal in a fight, dangerous in an executive, and potentially catastrophic in a chief executive. And he says that fortunately it can be unlearned, but the individual has to accept ownership of the problem and be willing to address it. And I think that's where I go back to, yeah, you may be able to change some of your behaviors here and there, but if your belief system is in place, that takes a much bigger change to really occur in order to change your overall behaviors. And I would ask whether or not Hillary really is about to change her basic belief systems at all. I would have to say I doubt it. This guy happens to be a technology expert, supposedly, and he says he's been getting a number of calls on her emails, and he doesn't think anyone really sees the big problem, and it isn't about what she used, it's about how she reached her decision. Obviously, Hillary's an attorney, so she should have a good grasp of what the laws are, and he says that as an attorney, she's been a part of a number of investigations, and as a result, she wanted to better control her email repository so that it couldn't easily be used against her. And given that her background is such that she's been in a lot of problems, has had a lot of problems, but she's always managed to get out of them. The question is this going to be the same case here? He doesn't seem to think so. He says that if she had thought strategically, she would have realized that even the appearance of this personal email system would imply she had something to cover up and would create big problems for a presidential run. I'm just wondering if maybe Hillary's become a IT expert in terms of, because she kept saying about them setting up this email server and her own having her own email server. So I'm wondering when she became a IT wizard and knew how to set all this stuff up. He goes on to say, he says that tunnel vision was one of the most fascinating differences between men and women that actually should make women better executives and politicians, because usually women are a lot more capable at multitasking than men are, obviously. And he says the concern is that this is something that she doesn't seem to have. But I don't know if I can agree with them entirely because she does seem to be able to handle all the attacks coming at her from all the directions. And one of the things I see is that she's always above the law. It's that mindset, it's that belief system that she doesn't have to follow the rule of law in any way, shape, or form. And she can ignore media attacks, she can ignore the left, she can ignore the right and do whatever she pleases. And people like Hillary, by their nature, don't trust people as individuals and feel that, well, whether we're, you know, heading into Circle K to grab our big gulp or whatever, we require all the nanny state to handle us, but she doesn't seem to apply that to herself in any way at all. And I think the thing that we really have to take a look at is whether or not people are going to really be willing to take a hard look at what she's doing and say no. You know, personally, I'm just tired of the, what would you call it, Oscar, the monarchy of the Clintons and the Bushes, because I don't want either one of them. I'm not going...
Yeah, dynastic politics.
Mm. Right. Jeb, maybe he's a great guy. Maybe he's a great politician. Maybe he'd make a good president, but...
Another Bush?
Another Bush. And I'm not voting for that, and I'm not motivated to vote for it. And the same way on the other side of the fence. And these kind of things just seem to keep coming up over and over. I don't know if you saw the cover of Time magazine where they actually have Hillary in kind of just a shadow of her full body. It's not a picture of her, but a shadow of her, and you know it's her because the cover makes a comment about whether or not she'll get out of it again this time. Well, in that cover, they've placed it, the picture, the shadow, exactly so that the capital M above her head looks like somebody put devil horns on Hillary. Now, I don't know, according to this one, they claim that it might be inadvertent. You know, the Clinton way is the cover, and it says they write their own rules. Will it work this time? And you can just see the little devil horns sticking out there. So I'm wondering if maybe Hillary really is the Antichrist. You hear all these people saying Obama's the Antichrist over and over and over. And I think, well, maybe not. Hillary seems to be the one that comes back from these mortal wounds over and over again. And so the question is, will she make it back from this one? Because I don't think her belief system's changing at all in any way. And so the question is, are you going to keep out there allowing this kind of thing to go over and over, being above the law? It's not something I want to see. You know, the Secret Service, same kind of thing. There seems to be this belief that if you're in the government, you can be above the law. Well, it's time to change our belief systems, get back to what the country was founded on. We'll be right back. We're back, Solomon on Blast. Now, John Cougar, or John Mellencamp, says he's the American fool, maybe. But it seems like there's more than just American fools out there when you look at this next story. In Proverbs 14:15, Solomon says, "The simple believes every word, but the prudent considers well his steps." This particular article talks about email, more email stuff today. The email scam with centuries of history. Now, everybody out there has probably encountered those wonderful emails from different places around the world. Probably the most notable one is the one from Nigeria. It says everyone knows that Nigerian prince doesn't really need your help, and he probably really isn't a Nigerian prince. But in his email, you know, you receive this claim that he's estranged from his huge amounts of money. And although you're a stranger to him, he needs your help, right? Getting it back. He promises to handsomely reward you in exchange for that just little minor favor of sending him a little bit of money so he can do some of the work and send you millions of dollars. And you probably wonder, do people really fall for this stuff? Well, when you look at it, probably so. But at the same time, you probably think, why? After all this time, how could anybody fall for this kind of stuff? And is this something new associated with the fact that the internet's out there and you've got all this email and the ability to hit millions of people at any point in time? Well, it turns out that the email scam has got centuries of history behind it. There was an article around 1914 called The Spanish Prisoner Letter that talked about this same kind of thing. In this letter, it starts out, it says, "Dear Sir, although I know you only from good references of your honesty, my sad situation compels me to reveal to you an important affair in which you can procure a modest fortune, saving at the same time that of my darling daughter." And this is called the Spanish Prison Letter from about April 1914. So this thing has been around there forever. These kinds of scams are called advance fee fraud because the victim, the fool, the simple, is asked to pay a small fee in advance of receiving a large payment, which just so happens to never show up. It's also called Nigerian money offer because, like I said, a lot of these originate out of Nigeria. The Nigerian criminals led a wave of these when in the 80s, Nigeria was home to a bunch of mail and fax-based advance fee schemes. So they started even before the internet. They were using mail and fax-based. It's also called the 419 scam, if you haven't heard of that. It's a section of the Nigerian criminal code that deals with the fraud. But in fact, it goes much, much further back than that. And in 1898, there was a New York Times article that described a scam that could easily describe the version still in circulation today, only, like I said, they called it the Spanish Prisoner. And from an article titled "An Old Swindle Revived," it says a man in this country receives a letter from a foreign city. The letter's written as fairly well-educated foreigners write English, with a word misspelled here and there. So maybe that's why they keep misspelling words here and there, to make it sound like it's real rather than seem like it's totally fake. And an occasional foreign idiom. The writer is always in jail because of some political offense. He always has some large sums of money hid and is invariably anxious that it should be recovered. He knows of the prudence and good character of the recipient of the letter through a mutual friend whom he does not mention for reasons of caution, and appeals to him in time of extremity for help. He is willing to give one-third of the concealed fortune to the man who will recover it. And they actually, in this article, they have a picture of the actual letter, nice cursive writing and everything. And the belief was that there were actually references to this in this particular article that go back 30 years prior to the article. So the article was 1898, and so they're saying somewhere around 1868, this same thing was happening. And the Times article was warning Americans against it. And the French had been suffering from the same kind of problem even longer than that. So when we come back, we'll take a little more look at this and then go on to our final segment. But we'll be back right after these usual commercial messages. Give us a call if you want to weigh in. Okay, we're back. Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. So this email scam, or the Nigerian scam, or whatever it's been called, really goes back even further, like I was saying, to early 1800s. In 1832, there was a gentleman by the name of Eugene Vidicot, a French criminal turned private investigator, that detailed swindles executed by prisoners. Prisoners obtained addresses of certain rich people living in Providence, he says, which was easy from the number of prisoners who were constantly arriving. They then wrote letters to these rich people, referred to as letters of Jerusalem. And as one of the examples they have is, "Sir, you will doubtlessly be astonished at receiving a letter from a person unknown to you who is about to ask a favor from you, but from the sad condition in which I am placed, I am lost if some honorable person will not lend me succor. That is the reason of my addressing you, of whom I have heard so much that I cannot for a moment hesitate to confide all my affairs to your kindness." And he goes on to say basically that he and his master had a casket consisting of 16,000 francs in gold and diamonds. And what ends up happening is, "Hey, we need you to help us out in obtaining this casket." Now, amazingly, back at that point in time, the letter had a 20% response rate. So 20% of the people that they sent this letter out to actually responded to it. But you got to ask yourself, why does this keep happening over and over? Well, according to this article, the short explanation for why it hasn't died out is because it's still working. And it's still working for a lot of the same reasons, he says, that it did 200 years ago. As it worked in the older Times article, it talks about why it was so prevalent and why it worked. It says, as it worked in two countries, the detection and punishment of operators are practically impossible, especially as the victims rarely complain. The article says nobody knows how many people had been cheated or how many thousands of dollars had been sent from the country in pursuit of the buried fortune that is always the bait. Well, it usually preys upon the very vain and gullible. These people are often too embarrassed to come forward as victims. Estimates of the losses to advanced fee fraud right now are all over the place, but American complaints totaled $198.4 million in 2007, and UltraScan claims $12.3 billion lost to the con in 2013. And the fact that money is being transferred overseas, often countries with relatively poor banking infrastructure, make it hard to trace and recover the money. So there's few things that have changed in the modern era, and because of the internet, a lot of people know about the fraud, so there's fewer people that will fall for it, but the claims are still outlandish, and it takes a pretty particular greedy and trusting eye not to spot them. And I think that's where, you know, the simple are very much so believing every word, like I said at the beginning. And one Microsoft researcher points out that the low conversion rate on these, where they send out millions and millions of them, actually works to their advantage, because, again, you have to be pretty gullible to reply to it. And once they do find out they've been scammed, as always, people don't want to admit it to anybody. So the thing continues on, and you got to just not be simple. It's amazing that this stuff has been going on for as long as it has, a couple hundred years. Be smart. Be wise. Don't fall for these things. So we'll come back with another segment of Solomon on Blast right after these quick messages. Wow, do you want to be like Albert Einstein? According to this article, maybe, maybe not. Proverbs says, "Let not mercy and truth forsake you, bind them around your neck." Write them on the tablet of your heart, and so find favor and high esteem in the sight of God and man. Albert Einstein wrote a letter in Italian back in the early 1900s where he actually described God as a creator. Well, that letter sold recently for a crazy amount, but not that crazy, $75,700, or it was actually, the article quotes it in pounds, 49,000 pounds. It says the 1925 letter was written to the Italian electrical engineer Giovanni Giorgio to defend Einstein's theory of relativity from 10 years earlier. The letter was uncharacteristically written in Italian, and it was written by Einstein after he faced a lot of harsh criticism from an American physicist by the name of Dayton Miller, who aimed to disprove the theory. And to move to discredit Miller's findings, Einstein wrote, "I agree with your opinion on the fact that the movement of an ether with a mathematical formula so high is particularly impossible." He said, "God created the world with more intelligence and elegance." And the interesting part about this is that Einstein was really pretty much a professed agnostic, and he had actually written another letter, one called, everybody refers to as the God letter, that he wrote in 1954 to a gentleman by the name of Eric Gutkind in response to the author's book about Choose Life, the Biblical Call to Revolt. And in that one, he says, the word of God is for me nothing more than the expression and product of human weaknesses. The Bible, a collection of honorable but still primitive legends, which are nevertheless pretty childish. For me, the Jewish religion, like all other religion, is an incarnation of the most childish superstitions. And the Jewish people to whom I gladly belong, with whose mentality I have a deep affinity, have no different quality for me than all other people. Now, the amazing thing about that letter is that it sold a few years back for just over $3 million on eBay. So it seems like people that wanted to be like Einstein and be agnostic and or even atheist and believe that there is no God were much more willing to spend a lot more money, $3 million, to be like Einstein versus the people that wanted to buy the letter that he had written indicating that there actually was a God. So it's kind of ironic because at one point in time, Einstein himself had written, "The only source of knowledge is experience." But I think what he forgot is that without God, there's no wisdom at all. It's just men making up a lot of stuff. So in our final segment, our One Greater Than Solomon segment for this week, John 4:10 says Jesus, in this particular section of John, he's talking to the woman that he meets at the well. He says, Jesus answered and said to her, If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. Well, this story's about a lady by the name of Annie Lobert, and this is her testimony about her life and what she was dealing with, her belief system, and how it had to change in order for her to be able to make a difference and a change in her life. Listen to this. It's about almost 14 minutes long, so I think it's worth listening to the whole thing, and after that, we'll come back. You got that ready for me, Oscar? Okay, go ahead. Cue that up. Enjoy this.
Little girl lost. Thought no one loved her. Thought no one wanted her. Ran away from her castle. She was embraced by the devil and his false love, and through that embracing became a different person, became the harlot, became the queen of lies, the Jezebel. That's my life. Growing up, I just remember my dad just raging. I'd come home and my dad would be really angry, stressed out. And I really took it personal. And I think that I thought to myself that I must be unlovable. High school, noticed that the boys were paying attention to me. And since I wasn't getting any attention from my dad, I gravitated toward any compliment, any pass that was made at me. I met this boy in school that stole my heart. He told me if I slept with him, we'd get married, we'd make a life together, we'd have babies. And I completely took my entire heart and gave it to this boy. And when I found out that he was sleeping with several of my best girlfriends, it was such a shock to me. Left high school, heartbroken, moved out of my parents' home. The day after I graduated, I remember waving at my mom when I was 18 and my dad and in the back of the car, knowing I'd never come back because I was done. I got out into the beautiful city of Minneapolis, tried to find a way to go to college, but I had to work three jobs to have my own place and buy a car. And I found like a new thing inside of me that if I had nice clothes, if I went out to the clubs, I could meet different men that liked me, and maybe I could meet a rich guy that would sweep me off my feet and take care of me like a prince would. And so my girlfriend and I started going out to the nightclubs, and we had a fake ID. And one night we walked in. These men walked up to us at the bar and bought us drinks, Rolex watches, designer clothes. I looked at my girlfriend. These guys have money. My girlfriend starts to like one of the men. I told my girlfriend, get that guy's money. And I think what this really was building inside me was this vendetta, this deep-seated, rooted unforgiveness towards my dad, towards that boy in school. And I just wanted revenge. I was going to prove that I could make it in my life. And money was going to be the answer. My girlfriend takes off with this guy, goes to Hawaii. I'm working my three jobs. She calls me up and says, listen, I am on the beach. I'm in a drop-top Corvette, and I'm on my cell phone, and you need to come out here. And even though I didn't have the guts to ask her, you know, what are you doing? I just kind of went with it. It was like an automatic walking into a dark doorway that I knew something wasn't right. But the lure of the possibility of having nice things and finally having money that I never had growing up, finally being someone important, overrode all those feelings of any caution, and it blew it to the wind. And I went to Hawaii that very week, took a vacation from my jobs. And the first night that I was on Waikiki Beach, I actually sold myself with my girlfriend to some Japanese clients, and I became a prostitute. It's kind of like I had this ring that I put on and I couldn't take it off. No longer could $3.47 an hour cut it. Once I found out that I could make hundreds, if not thousands of dollars, selling myself $500 an hour with no attachment, no relationship, $1,000 an hour. Now it was $2,000 an hour. It gave me this immense power. And if he wanted me for the night, that was $10,000. A few months later, I started dancing. And One day I was on the stage, and this man walks in, puts this couple $100 fan of money at my feet. And I danced just for him. And I let him know that I was actually prostituting my body. I was actually selling myself to make extra ends meet. He looked at me and said, "You are so intelligent. I really like you. In fact, I think I'm falling in love with you." He gave me everything that I needed to hear from my dad. And I decided that I wanted to move to Las Vegas. I got off the plane, and that night I went on a couple calls. I brought home a nice wad of money. My boyfriend was there, and he told me to break myself. "What did you say to me?" He said, "Break yourself." And that means give me all your money, dump your purse out on my lap. And I wasn't having it. And he proceeded to take me out by my hair. He choked me. He threw me on the porch on my knees, and he started kicking me. "This is pimpin', B. I'm just choking on my own blood. You're going to work for me." Punching me in my face. "Time it is, but what time it is now is you're going to pay me." My nose broke. My ribs broke. It was like I was looking at the devil. The prince turned dark. "And if you try to leave, I'll kill you." That night, it's like I died inside. And the next 5 years of my life, I was with a pimp. Every time he hit me and choked me and raped me or put guns to my head, made me do things I never wanted to do, I just did it because I loved him and because out of fear, because I knew if I didn't, that I would not live to see another day. And even though I got away from him, everything you give, you leave. The money, the cars, the houses, all behind. Because when you leave a pimp, you leave with nothing. I started stacking my money again, but the money wasn't the same. I came down with cancer. And a couple years later, lost all my hair, had chemotherapy, had Hodgkin's lymphoma. I started taking painkillers for my bone pain and my marrow, and I got addicted to painkillers, and that led into cocaine. I was going on calls bald with wigs because I had lost all my hair from chemotherapy. And I had clients calling me a cancer bee. I'm staying in these seedy motels, and I remember laying there in my bed looking in the mirror at myself, thinking that God was angry with me. I would get in the shower and I would scrub my body, and I would think, I'll never, ever be clean. I started freebasing cocaine. And one night, I just decided that I was just going to get higher than I could, than I've ever been before, because I just wanted to erase all the pain of the cancer, the pain of my uncle, my sister, and my grandpa dying within 3 months of each other, the pain of losing all those years with my family up in the Midwest, the pain of losing all my friends, losing my cars, losing everything I had ever made. I took the hit of that coke, and I fell back. I went completely blind. It's like the whole room, the light that was on in that room turned dark. And I remember laying there, and I felt like this demonic presence just come over me, that I was completely alone. And I got really, really scared, and I just instinctively knew. I knew that I was at death's door. I was in this dark, dark cave, and I knew it was over. And I saw my family. I saw my funeral. And I was in the coffin. And everybody was crying, and they were wiping their faces, and they were saying, "She was just a prostitute." That's when I said, "Jesus, please save me. I don't know if you're real, but I don't want to die." The ambulance came, and the doctor came up to me, and he grabbed my hand, and he said, You are lucky to be alive. You have so much drugs in your system, little lady. You should be dead. God must be with you. And I knew that Jesus heard my prayer. And I laid there. And I had this peace come over me that was nothing like I'd ever felt in my entire life. And I knew God gave me a second chance. I got better and I started reading my Bible. I recovered and was afraid to go to church. Come on, an ex-prostitute. Do I think if I walk in church, people are going to look at me and really love me? But I walked in that church and people embraced me. And God just really started doing that inner healing. And the Holy Spirit was just like speaking to me, telling me that I was beautiful and that I was chosen and that I was set apart and that I was sanctified and I was a holy vessel for Him. I started to stand on Jesus' words that I'm whole, that I'm healed, that I'm pure, that I'm a virgin in Him. And that gives me peace. I remember I was vacuuming my house one day, and the Lord said to me, He said, Annie, I want you to go back down to that strip, and I want you to tell the girls that are in slavery that I love them. And so that's what I'm called to do, to simply tell them, God loves you. No matter where you've been, no matter what you've done, no matter how deep, how dirty you feel, that there's redemption. You are white as snow when you accept Him into your heart. Little girl lost, thought no one loved her, thought no one wanted her, ran away from her castle. But God met her on that dark road. He said, you can come home now. And I'm right here, and I never left you. Redemption, redeemed, set free. That's my life, His love.
That's Annie Lovert's testimony, and now she's written a book about her life, an autobiography called Fallen. She's released that just this past February, and I wanted to play that partially because of this movie that's out there, The 50 Shades of Grey, and this is reality with respect to that particular genre of films and stuff. You see it, Hollywood makes it all out to be such a great thing, but this woman's life is the real side of that, that abuse and the prostitution just was something that she couldn't escape from. And it wasn't until she had that change, that powerful change like I talked about at the beginning, that completely changed her belief system. And that was an encounter with Christ Himself. That's where the real power is and the real ability to change. So, until next week, keep thinking wisely.